It's strange, isn't it? Just one of those peculiar chances, that's all. I didn't even know who he was. Just a coincidence, pure coincidence, that's all.
That's Pauling. The coincidence she is talking about concerns a book, The Siege of Krishnapur by J.G. Farrell.
That's my abiding thought of that book. I can't believe that someone would eat a beetle, even in stress, so it shows people will do anything. I loved it. It's a lovely book.
She read the book back in the August of 1979. The next week, Pauline and her children went for a walk on the Sheepshead Peninsula.
We were there merely that day because we used to go to what we called the Secret Valley, because it's an end of the peninsula where there's nothing but peat diggings for two or three miles.
On the edge of the shore, there was a man sea fishing off a rock.
Unusual to see anybody down here. Normally there's nobody around down here. We walk along the rocks and there's some man fishing off rocks. I didn't really know who he was. I just assumed he was sort of 40s. Slender man, about to cast. Could have been anybody. I had no idea who he was. And while I was just turning round to do something else, they yelled, "He's fallen in the water. The wave's taken him in the water." And then I saw him in the water. I mean, it was just so incredible to see somebody just floating about in the water, just his head. That's all. I screamed at them and said that I'm going down to see if I can reach him, with my jacket. But of course, then they really started to yell. That's when all the screaming and shouting started. Don't go down there, Mummy. And I went down just to go down the ledge, and he'd have seen me starting to climb down the rock. And he obviously thought that I was going to get in the water. But he saw that I was going to come down, that there were three children there. There was a fair chance of one of those boys coming down after me. He saw the situation, knew I wouldn't be able to get him, and we'd both get drowned. And he looked at me. He looked at the boys, and he just went under.
The man in the water was the author of The Siege of Krishnapur, J.G. Farrell. He had been only living in West Cork for 149 days. This is the story of that time.
Everything is just in a small piece of time, and there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
I remember the day he arrived, now coming to think of it. He arrived, I think, about 2 days before his furniture came. And his furniture and his wine arrived at the same time.
James Gordon Farrell moved to Kilcrohan on the Sheepshead Peninsula in late March 1979.
Anybody that comes into the area, the first thing the people wonder as we're smart, everybody know what's happening in the area, who has bought the property. We're in the Bantry Bay site here, a small little half a dozen houses. We were very curious about a writer coming into our midst.
Farrell was 44 years of age, author of the renowned Empire trilogy, the winner of the Booker Prize, and for the first time in his life, the owner of a home.
When he bought it, it was totally covered with ivy. You could just see the chimneys. And I think this kind of attracted him, that that this was kind of symbolic in some way, that he was going to make something out of it. And it was kind of, it was a bit like an immigrant, I felt, an immigrant returning to his roots.
The department says a strike next week would stop all mail as well as counter services in all main post offices and all phone calls, home and international, which need the services of an operator.
But in 1979, there was a postal strike and petrol rationing.
At home, motorists are still queuing for petrol despite the higher prices.
The decision, after a two-hour private debate, was unanimous as expected. An emergency resolution asks sections of the engineering union to withdraw those services being used by government and business in an attempt to defeat the 16-weeks-old strike.
I'm not quite sure if he was a little bit overwhelmed by the move when it actually came, that he had been cut off, because it was a very isolated place. He didn't have a telephone over there at the time, so he was quite isolated.
It had been quite the journey to Kilcrohan, taking in India, the Arctic, Oxford, and Paris, to name but a few. These are stories, though, for another time.
This is by way of a signal rocket to let you know that I'm still alive despite this never-ending postal strike and a petrol shortage. Well, so far things have not been going too badly, and I'm beginning to feel at home here. A move is hard work at my advanced age, but I seem to have settled in okay, and so far I've not missed London. It's extremely beautiful here and very peaceful.
Sometimes I said, is this a diversion? Shouldn't you be writing? And he said, no, I've plenty of time for that.
This is Gerry O'Mahony. He sold J.G. Farrell the house, and back then was in the process of renovating it.
He'd always offer to make you tea or have a glass of wine. Maybe it was just an excuse for himself to have a glass, I'm not quite sure, but he was that was the kind of guy he was. That if you called, he didn't talk to you at the door. You had to go in and sit down, and usually you wound up talking for maybe 2 hours or whatever. Like
the first time I saw him was he was in his laneway, and I saluted him. The first time I met him was over at his residence, which he had purchased. The name is Gurfahan. There I rapped at the door and I gave him the fish, and I remember to the pollock I gave him.
This is Gerry Daly. His farm sits on a hill about a mile away, overlooking J.G. Farrell's home.
And my father and grandfather always fished down. They had a boat and they always fished out at the sea down by the cove. And it was a tradition, and it's still a tradition today. We always give fish to our neighbours. It doesn't matter whether they're new into the area, whether they're right or they're whoever they are. We always take them around, and it's, if we get a fish, we give them a sample of fresh fish. He was asking me, how did we cook it? And I said, traditionally here, you fillet it off, you can boil it, put a bit of, shake a bit of brown flour in and fry it, and it's beautiful. I remember stopping with the tractor one day. He was out by the road to say hello to him. So I stopped mainly to say, did he like the fish? And he said they were lovely. What he'd like to do was, he said, was to be able to catch him himself. So I said, you have to buy him. He said, what would he need? And I said, buy him a fishing rod. And you can catch him no bother down at the cove by this, just down the laneway from his residence.
Far as I remember, it was, the weather was good, you know, and it was a real tonic. It was a real tonic to be out there in fine weather. I'm sure you wouldn't, the days are long at that time.
Today, the sun is shining, the sea is sparkling, and all seems right with Kilcrohan, if not with the world. I plan to start serious work on my novel again next week.
I remember he phoned up one evening in a panic. A bees had there was an old window in the back of the house. It was bedroom upstairs, and the window was closed off, and there was a cavity in the wall inside the outer layer of stones, behind the outer layer of stones. It wasn't properly filled up, and a swarm of bees went in there. And on the inside of the wall, it was a plasterboard, which was only a half inch thick. And of course, the bees started buzzing quite loudly in the middle of the night. And it was quite near where the head of his bed was. And this was he panicked at the thought that the bees might come through at some stage. So he asked me, because I was a beekeeper at the time, could I take them out or what could I do? And I said, you know, if you, in the old custom here was that if it was unlucky to give away your swarm of bees if they came. He said, oh, okay.
I forget whether the bees had arrived in a hole in the wall over the back door when you were here. I think not. This is considered a great piece of luck hereabouts. By a coincidence, Jerry had told me a couple of days earlier that he was about to purchase a swarm. It never occurred to me that he wouldn't be a beekeeper as well as everything else.
And then I think after two or three days, the noise of the bees got too much, so I had to take them out for him. So he was going to keep bees then, and I put the bees in a box and put them by the apple trees.
There are two large-scale bits of news. The first is, I found a dead rat by the fireplace this morning. One has to nerve oneself up a bit to this sort of thing if one lives in the country, I suppose.
So he had a problem with rats at one stage, all right. And I think he got... there was a dead rat somewhere, and he was kind of panicking at this. And I said, this is the country, this is not London, so the rats don't have any disease, you know. I was telling him a story about when the neighbours came into the old man who lived there before him, that the rat came out of the wall one night and someone of the men caught the rat by the tail and pulled off his tail. So he you see, this, and another part of that story was when he used to put the fire on in the main room, the smoke would go all along horizontally along the wall for about 20 or 30 metres and come out in his study, and he found this intriguing. But obviously the smoke was following an old path that the rats had worn through the stones.
As you will see, this is the sort of corn-pone drama that fills my days, while you sophisticated folk have such fancy items as the Jeremy Thorpe show. Life is bliss here, despite rabbits that eat my crops and bees that have taken up residence in the hall of my bedroom.
So what kind of Britain is it likely to be with Margaret Thatcher at the helm? Anthony Howard is former editor of the New Statesman. He's currently
the day I flew over to visit him in Ireland was the day Margaret Thatcher was elected first as Prime Minister.
This is Anne Kitts. Back then, she was Anne Colville.
Which, of course, was something that just appalled Jim. I mean, the idea of Margaret Thatcher as Prime Minister, he was just aghast.
...to Alec Douglas Hume. Mr. Heath was a hiccup along the way. You're right about that.
We talked about that a lot because he was so... I think the returns were coming in that night. Oh, I would have been 26, 27. And Jim was 13 years or 14 years older. We saw each other for on and off for years. I mean, Jim loved women and women loved Jim. But anyway, and there was Jim and he had a little, I think it was a little blue car. I'd never thought of him as driving, so that was interesting. And we drove to the house. It seemed very remote. He really was excited by it. He had this guy named Jerry who was doing the work, and he seemed to get on with him well. And he had some nice neighbors that we went to see. He loved being in the country, I think, and he liked the quiet, and I think he liked having his own place. This is a stupid thing to say, but it's really hard to be a good writer like that. It is really, really hard work, and I don't think he had figured out how he could, you know, live and have a, for example, live in a house with a wife and children and still write, you know? I think that was something, when he was really writing, he just wanted to be alone. And, I mean, I'd grown up with a father who was an artist, and he would go off and be alone in his studio. But we had a whole family rhythm, you know? I mean, the house was where we were four children, cat, dog, all kinds of stuff. And my father would go and he'd work and be away from us all. But then he'd come down and, you know, the whole family thing would go on. But I don't think Jim had kind of figured out how he was going to, how he could make that work. He once took care of my cat and he said, you know, it's such a distraction having a cat, isn't it? But I think we did kind of talk about the fact that we couldn't imagine, you know, living together, that, you know, that that wasn't something that either of us kind of really thought was going to happen. He'd given me a copy of his book, Girl in a Head, to read on the plane on the way home. And he'd made some kind of deprecating remarks about the book, and we talked about that a bit. We were not expecting never to see each other again, you know?
He went and he purchased the new fishing rod, all the tackle with it, everything, all brand new. And I met him about a week later, and I said, how do you get on with the did you try for any fish? And he said, I've been down on a couple of occasions, and I've tried, and not even one. He said, I mustn't have the right gear, or I mustn't have the right knack of catching the fish. Anyone can catch fish down there. I said to him, once you're fishing the right spot, where were you fishing? And he said, just on the slipway. I said, you might as well try there in the kitchen sink. I'll take you down one of the days and I'll take you over to one rock in particular and I'll show it to you. It's called Conagra Hog.
He was getting very depressed on the fishing front because April and May is the time of the year when fish are very scarce, and he figured that he was using the wrong technique. So
I took him down and we went down. He had fish with the rod before, as I said, over by the plat, so he had no bothering in casting out. What I was very concerned about was the rocks. They're quite slippery and dangerous. And I remember saying to him, just sit up farther before we start fishing. Sit down and have a look for 5 minutes at the sea and see how it is. And I remember we caught, I caught three and he caught one small little fella. And I said, you have no bother now, you can try yourself. And he got pollock. I remember he told me the size. He was amazed the size he was catching, and he was absolutely delighted with his, with the, and that was the rock he went to all the time to fish.
My book is at last making a little progress, though it has a rival now, viz. Fishing off the rocks. I know no one is going to believe me, but I've actually been catching fish and eating them. Great fun, and beats writing into a cocked hat.
Then when the mackerel arrived in, he couldn't believe how he could go down. He could really live off the land. There was mackerel every day. Spent about 2 hours every day fishing in the afternoon. I think it was his relaxation from about 2 to 4. The fishing boat had caught him big time. And he couldn't believe that you could go fishing and that the afternoon would go by so quickly.
I spend my evenings fishing off the rocks for mackerel and pollock, and an old grandpa seal who looks as if he's wearing a 20s bathing cap treads water 30 yards away and watches me with the air of someone who thinks he knows a better way of doing it. Minor disasters include the fact that the tractor that came up to rotivate the garden, which was full of brambles, broke the sewage pipe to the septic tank.
It was a problem for a few days before he spotted the problem. Pretty foul smell, and You know, he was a little bit panicky about these small things, which was so rejoining from one person living in the house, so it wasn't to like a main, a storage main in a big city or something.
I went out for a walk the other day, and when I came back, a herd of cows was just polishing off the last of the cabbages. They'd also trampled on some other stuff and nibbled at the pear trees I'd just planted.
He was quite annoyed about this, I remember, because this cabbage was very important. It was going to keep him over the winter. But the cows had other ideas.
I knew I was expected at a certain time, and I asked him what I could bring, and he said, "Well, I write on coffee, meaning as my fuel." And he said, "If you could go to the Monmouth Street coffee place." Now, this is a real, it's an extension of Neil's Yard, which is a famous old sort of natural foods, whole foods, organic foods place in London, and there's a little coffee place next to it. And he asked me, could I bring a bulk supply of a particular type of Colombian coffee beans? And so I simply doubled the quantity in my head, and I think it brought him something else. So my luggage was very Spartan, except for a knapsack absolutely reeking of gorgeous coffee beans, which he would then grind. I felt I should declare the coffee beans, and there was a very, very young, fresh-faced young customs officer at Cork, and I went through the something to declare channel, and he looked at me and he said, "What have you?" I said, "Well, I brought these coffee beans. It's a present for a friend. I bought them." And he said, "They're coffee beans. Where are they from again?" I said, I got them from London. And he looked quite pained. He said, "I didn't think they grew it there." And I said, no, it was...
David Simpson would be the last person to stay with J.G. Farrell.
I was there for only a week, precisely a week. When Jim was showing me round his house, there was a study, a small study. It was quite bare, apart from books and things, and a typewriter. And I noticed on it that he had an electronic clock with lit-up numerals, and I think his were pink, and I had an identical clock to that in my flat in London, where the numerals were greenish-blue. And I said to him, "I've got identical clock." And I told him which shop I'd got it from, and because this was quite new in those days. I mean, digital clocks are everywhere now. But to have one that lit up, so you could see it if you woke up at night, you could see it on the dressing table, you know, some distance away. There were not big enough numbers. And there was a colon in between the hours and the minutes, and it flashed once per second. And Jim's didn't have the colon. And I said, "But mine's got a flashing two dots between, you know, the hours and the minutes for the seconds, you know, just so that you know it's working and all that." And Jim said, "Well, I didn't like the flashing. I felt I was watching my life ebbing away each time it flashed. So I took it to pieces, and I took a piece of paper from the side of a book of stamps, and I stuck it at the place where the colon would show through."
I took him into the pub a few times in the White House Bar. Friday evening was when the old people collected the pension. There was quite a good gathering and sing-song, and he enjoyed this. But he didn't sing. He just listened in the background. I'm sure he took notes.
Over the course of the summer, Gerry O'Mahony and Jim Farrell had become good friends.
Jim came around and had tea with us often, and you know, he made faces at the kids and things. But he was an extremely shy, polite man, is the way I'd describe him. There was no airs and graces at all to him.
Over those couple of months, they watched each other working. Gerry renovating, Jim writing.
He often said to me, he said, "Why don't you write a book?" I mean, fellow, he was intrigued to think that you could be a beekeeper, a builder, a deep sea diver, and a farmer, and all these. This sort of intrigued him because he had just the one pet, you know. I had studied a bit of English in college, and I mean, writers were kind of remote people up to that point in my life. You took a book out and you read it and you saw a bit about the character on the cover. It was refreshing, and it was another, it gave you a great understanding and kind of awareness as to what a writer, that writing a book wasn't that easy, that you know, you could hit the wall and that you'd have to get yourself out of the hole and go on and finish it. This was something that, you know, it was the first time that had occurred to me, that being a writer is not an easy job. He was writing a book at the time, and I think he had hit a wall something around May or June, that there were he wasn't producing very much, and I'd say he spent a few weeks kind of a few weeks when he was under the weather, to put it that way. And then I remember at some stage, sort of towards the middle of July, when he was in flying form again. I probably admired the man for, you know, what he was doing. I was fascinated by his lifestyle. That this, you know, you could actually make money without doing physically hard work, and he seemed to be getting by pretty good. Here was a man who had left the city and all the pluses of the city, and could survive. I thought when he came first that he probably survived for 3 or 4 months, and I could see as the time went by that he was there for the long haul, that he wasn't going to be a passerby.
Dear Rosemary, thanks for your note re my new book.
The day before he died, Jim Farrell wrote to his publisher.
I haven't finally decided on the title and doubt if there's any point in announcing the book without it. I'm running a bit behind schedule, but I'm still confident that, barring some unforeseen disaster, I'll provide you with a novel of 80,000 to 100,000 words before the end of the year.
The words, "barring some unforeseen disaster," still jump off the page.
But as soon as we got down to the top of the rocks, it was, you know, you could see the guy standing there, you know, just fishing, minding his own business. So I guess as soon as we got down there, it was very obvious there was someone standing there alone fishing. I guess I was probably 10 or 11. And he was just standing there completely isolated, in an exceedingly desolate place, just a man in his own world. A particularly large wave or swell came up. They'd been lapping around his feet anyway, although lapping's perhaps a slightly gentle way of putting them. You know, they were thrashing around. One in particular, as they do from time to time, larger than the others, came up and literally just swallowed him up, as it were. Whether it actually went above his head, I don't recollect. I suspect it went pretty well all the way up his body. You know, the power of the sea just took him clean down the rocks.
He seemed to be being sucked further from, and then he seemed to come in a bit with a wave, seemed to come in so that I could see him when I went down to a kind of plateau, which is where the entrance is, and JG was standing on a ledge there. And there was a drop down, and I sort of got down that drop. He might be able to reach, and I might be able to reach his hand. That's all. It was a silly idea, but you can't be rational that quickly.
And the overriding memory I have was what we were concerned about was that my mother would actually try and get in, because she was a relatively strong swimmer, and I can remember both of us having to dissuade her quite, you know, forcefully to get in.
James was yelling at me not to go, screeching at me not to go. And what I'd intended to do was I started to climb down. I saw him, I looked at him, and he looked at me. And I saw that if I went down the rock, I thought I could take my jacket off and stand on the edge and hold on to a rock. And that's when they got panicky. And he looked at me. And I looked across at him, and he just went under, didn't he? Just went under.
J.G. Farrell's body was recovered 6 weeks later. He was buried in the cemetery of St. James's Church in Durris. Jerry O'Mahony and Jerry Daly carried his coffin.
In some way that I feel a bit responsible for what happened to him, you know. Maybe if I hadn't shown him
the rock, talked about fishing and taking him down. What if? But we can't turn back the time.
But then I started to read Jim's books all over again, the big three books, Troubles, and then The Siege of Krishnapur, and then The Singapore Crypt.
Edward said in somewhat sepulchral tones, "They gave their lives for their king, their country, and for us. Let us remain silent for a moment in their name." Silence descended.
There's so much of Jim in them. I found it a terrific comfort. And because they're so funny, it lightened the loss. So I was getting Jim back again, alive, on the page, if you like.
Meanwhile, the Major was trying once again to delve into the past with the paralysed fingers of his memory, hoping to grasp some warmth or emotion. The name, perhaps, of a dead friend that might mean the beginning of grief. The beginning of an end to grief. But now, as he stood at the breakfast table, even the dead faces that nightly appeared in his dreams remained absent.
Life is coincidence. Ultimately, it was a coincidence we were there, as unfortunate coincidence that we witnessed him falling into the sea, and it's a coincidence you walk into a bar.
The coincidence that James is talking about refers to a book, The Siege of Krishnapur by J.G. Farrell.
I can remember going to watch the Stone Roses at Lancaster and the spiral carpets, so yeah, that was the time. The college system at Lancaster was slightly different to most of the universities in the UK. It was a common room, sort of collegiate style, so a campus where there were 10 bars on one small restricted campus, which, as you can imagine, lends itself well to people overdoing it. A friend of mine from university when I was at Lancaster, who was from Afghanistan, and I can remember seeing him in the bar one evening reading The Siege of Krishnapur. Yeah, Jason was a very good friend. He was, he was a very, very, very well-read individual. He liked it. He'd read, Farrell's other books. I don't think it was the first time he'd read this. I just explained, what had happened. And to be honest, I think at that stage I didn't really know a great deal about Farrell. It just seemed very peculiar. So far away from anything had happened that there's the guy I know from the bar sat with a book next to him. And you see it, the memories come back and you think, wow. And literally just said, I saw this guy drown when I lived in Ireland.
I I was in London a few years ago having dinner with some people, and there was a poet there, and she and I were talking, and suddenly I realized from something she said that she also had been one of Jim's girlfriends. But you know what? We just smiled at each other and with a kind of recognition. And she said, oh, I love Jim. And I said, yes, I know.
So that's the best thing, I read the books. His books are they're not that easy to read. You can take him at a superficial level, and there's a much deeper level. And I think this was something about a man that you wouldn't get to this deep level, I think, for a long time. Six months would be too short a time to get to know the workings of his mind.